WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As you get ready for the holiday, we're going to take two looks back at 2007. First, our critic at large, John Powers, is going to run through his list of 10 cultural trends that emerged in 2007. John is also a film critic for Vogue. Well, John, let's start with what qualifies as a cultural trend? Like, what are the criteria, so to speak, for landing on your list of 10 cultural trends for the year?
Well, I was looking for things that happened in the course of a cultural and media year where we're all overwhelmed. I was looking for 10 things that stood out as either representing something new or something exciting or something that everybody was talking about, which defined this year as opposed to certain other years. I mean, I guess what I was trying to do, because so many trends actually continue over time, was to try to choose the things that might have hit some sort of tipping point this year where everybody noticed it, or just something that happened that had so many people talking that I thought we should talk about it.
I just want to say, I'm glad you said we're all overwhelmed. I thought it was just me.
Oh, no. I spend my entire life thinking, how do people watch 0.1% of all the things that are out there?
Yeah. Well, I have a copy of your list, and number one on the list is the permanent campaign. What's different about this campaign year from other years?
Well, I think the striking thing is that it started a year earlier. I remember that I knew we were in new territory when, at the end of March, the networks were covering who'd raised the most money for the primary campaigns more than a year before the election. In most of our lives, we've had election things happen in the year of the actual general election. Now it is continuous, so that there were all the debates and debates and debates, all the discussion of money. I mean, I'm really curious to see whether Americans will become sick of it or whether, in fact, most of them haven't even started paying attention yet. I was talking to the governor of Montana, who was saying, you know, he said, most people actually have lives, and it's only the political class and the media class that care about this. So that for them, this is the biggest thing because they're bored by governing, but they love politics and the horse race of politics. And so what that means is we've, in media terms, in cultural terms, is that we now have a period where the people in charge of the official discourse of the culture, of what we hear on the air, is fascinated with politics. So the election cycle seems to go on endlessly.
Well, let's look at number two on your list of 10 cultural trends from 2007. And you've headlined this one, Iraq movies fail at the box office. Which movies failed and how do you interpret that?
Well, if you start from the Valley of Ella to Rendition to Redacted, there have been a whole series of films about Iraq. Lions for Lambs is another one, or Iraq, or the War on Terror in general. Some of them are about Afghanistan as well. You could see that Hollywood was wanting to weigh in on the big historical moment and the big facts of the war. But Hollywood movies are very slow. So what has happened, I think, is that all these movies have come out this autumn, a year after all of these things had come out as books and been discussed on shows like Fresh Air. So that the people who might be the most interested in seeing these films have already, they're kind of tired of it. These stories aren't really telling us anything we didn't already know. I think the majority of Americans have decided that things had gone very badly in Iraq. And so to then go to a movie that proves this is of no great interest because that's just a depressing story. It's worth mentioning historically, you know, that during the Vietnam War, you didn't have, you know, for example, in the fall of 1969, six movies coming out about the Vietnam War. But you could feel the pressure in Hollywood. They want to have something to say about this. But because of what they're doing, it's so incredibly slow that what they're saying seems behind the curve. So that I think people, like when presented with a film like The Valley of Ella, will just think, we already know this. We learned this last year.
Well, on the other hand, there's a lot of dark movies that have opened this year and a lot of dark movies opening for, you know, that opened for the holidays. So do you see a connection between the movies about Iraq that didn't do well and the dark movies that have opened this year?
Well, I think, you know, that three of the most interesting and best movies at the end of the year are There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men and Sweeney Todd, and they're all incredibly dark movies. And I think part of what you see is that Hollywood is capturing some of the mood brought on by war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're reflecting that in movies that are, in fact, only metaphorically linked to what's actually going on. And it's, I think, no surprise that these are actually better movies as movies than the ones that are addressing Iraq directly, because Hollywood in general is always better at somehow capturing the mood of a country or a feeling of apocalypse or a feeling of danger or a feeling of a violent world as a metaphor than they are in directly addressing a political thing. And it must be said that, you know, that it's hard for me to imagine three bleaker good movies than No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, and Sweeney Todd. I mean, Sweeney Todd may be the most upbeat of the bunch.
My guest is John Powers, Fresh Air's critic at large, and he's put together his list of 10 cultural trends from 2007. Number three on your list is what you consider to be the TV moment of the year, which is?
The Sopranos ending, which in fact is not a trend. I have to admit it. But so many people talked about The Sopranos ending, it was impossible to not mention it. I mean, the idea of having the most talked about show perhaps in television history end with the screen going black and people thinking that HBO had suddenly had its service broken down or their cable company had failed was such a radical thing to do, because it's a kind of high art move in the midst of popular culture. And I was one of the many people who thought, dang, my cable went out. And I was enraged. And then when I realized, oh, that's actually what they've chosen to do, I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it took me several weeks to decide whether or not I was enraged or pleased by it. You know, months later, I think it's a brilliant move for two reasons. One, because how do you end a show that's talked about that much in a way that will have people talking? Well, one way is to just cut it off. Okay. The other reason it's brilliant is it was always an anti-mythic show. And a film like The Godfather or The Godfather Cycle, let's say Godfather 2, has to end with the big tragic ending. But in fact, the whole point of The Sopranos was that it isn't that. And so to therefore have the anti-mythic ending where, in fact, you just stop in the middle of things with the suggestion that it could go on forever or maybe Tony will be killed or maybe he won't is, in fact, a brilliant move in relation to what the show is trying to do.
And yet part of me still feels a little cheated. I think David Chase is such a great storyteller. I wanted him to commit to an end of the story.
Oh, I know. I understand completely. We all want the closure. And I think that this became sort of a meta message about how we want closure, which, as I say, is a high art move. You know, it's the kind of thing you'd expect Jean-Luc Godard to do rather than HBO. You know, I mean, I think the other great irony of it is, I mean, when many people thought, did HBO lose its feed at that moment? And in some metaphorical sense, it did, because since The Sopranos left, they haven't found anything to replace it. So it's almost as though HBO went off the air when The Sopranos ended.
Number four on your list of cultural trends from 2007, two stories about hitting the road. What are they?
Yes, well, only a few weeks apart, you had the 50th anniversary of On the Road, the Jack Kerouac novel about bombing across America in search of transcendence and friendship and all the rest, and the release of the Sean Penn film of John Krakauer's book, Into the Wild, which is the updated, maybe extreme generation version of this. And what I was struck by in this was the way that our idea of the road has changed, because when in On the Road, it is in many ways a joyous, liberating voyage of discovery where people are actually moving towards something positive. Yet the version that we now have is of the kid who goes up to Alaska all by himself, cuts himself off from humanity, going to the end of the line, and winds up dying. And you realize that somehow just our sense of what the road is has been transformed over the years. You know, when I was a kid, it still seemed like you could just drive to Montana and you'd be away from everything. Whereas now, today's kid thinks, maybe I have to go all the way to Alaska where there's nobody around. But there's so much more darkness in that than there is in On the Road. And I thought that actually says something about our perception of maybe moving around the American landscape, that it moves towards something bleaker and more isolated than it did before.
My guest is our critic at large, John Powers. We're talking about cultural trends that emerged in 2007. We'll continue his list after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Powers, Fresh Air's critic at large, and we're talking about his list of 10 cultural trends from 2007. Number five on your list is the TMZing of America. And I think before we expand on that, you should explain what TMZ is.
Well, TMZ was started off as a website which basically captured lots of video footage of celebrities being stupid. You know, that, you know, whenever Britney Spears did something idiotic or Paris Hilton, it would be online and you'd see it. So it's a pure celebrity gossip, insider, kind of prying. It's almost like a paparazzi website with slightly greater – it has delusions of grandeur, but it's essentially a paparazzi news site. It then later became a television show. And no one in America can turn on their television or go on the internet without noticing that we now have endless access to the most trivial details of celebrities and pseudo-celebrities and clowns' lives, that nothing that someone like Britney Spears does is ever happening in private. Now, at one level, you might say this is just because we're a corrupt, nasty culture interested only in trivial people. And that may even be true partly. But what struck me more about it was that the celebrities that are constantly on these sites being followed by cameras and having their antics shown on the internet is that they are the cutting edge of a transformation in our culture where we're breaking down the old ideas of what is public and what's private. Because what's spooky is not just that Britney Spears gets followed, but that if you go on YouTube or something, sometimes somebody will actually post something of people having an argument at a restaurant, and they will post that argument on a website, and they will have taped it on their cell phone or recorded it on their cell phone and putting it on a website, and these are people who aren't famous. That one of the strange things that's happening between that and the Facebooking of society, the MySpacing of society, and people photographing everything so that now every car chase is photographed by scads of people, is that the idea of there being a zone of privacy that we all have around us is being whittled away, often deliberately and happily. You know, one of the differences between me, say, and film critics who are, say, 20 years younger than I am is that film critics, strangers than I am, are much happier going online and blogging their every response to a movie. And I think, oh, no, you can't do that. In fact, you should save yourself for the review. And they think, oh, you old square, everybody blogs. What's the matter with you? And it's partly because I have this sense that my private and public space is very clearly defined. And their sense of what it is, what I consider private space, they consider public space.
Number 6 on your list of cultural trends from 2007, Jocks Gone Wild.
Oh, I mean, everybody knows this one. I mean, you know, we've recently had the Mitchell Report, which may be the classic example, you know, which is where you realize that huge numbers of famous baseball players have been taking steroids and human growth hormone. Earlier this year, Marion Jones admitted to doing it. You have Michael Vick doing that ghastly, you know, murdering dogs in ways that are even unpleasant by the normal ways that people murder dogs. You have the NBA ref. One of the interesting things that's happened here is that what people used to think of as some sort of refuge from the corruption of ordinary life now is pushing in your face the corruption of ordinary life, you know, that people routinely cheat. You know, I mean, the sympathy I have, if I can say, at least for some of the steroid people, is that it's cheating, and so therefore it's wrong. Okay, but that if you're a great player, the idea there'd be something that could make you greater can entice you into a Faustian bargain. I mean, you think that if someone like Barry Bonds or Roger Clemens, they're playing at such a high level, the thought that you could be even higher. I think that many people who are good at something could actually understand the impulse to do the something that might make you that little bit better. And then as for the other people, you know, they're just trying to survive in the business. You know, that you know, there's money to be made and careers to be made. And if a lot of people around you are taking steroids, you know, you'd better do it too, or you'd lose your job in the same way that, you know, in the old days you'd hear lots of talk about truck drivers using amphetamines. You can actually drive longer and faster using amphetamines. To me, it's essentially the same thing. If somebody told me that I could become a Nobel Prize winner by injecting myself with something, you know, I can't swear that I wouldn't do it.
My guest is John Powers. He's Fresh Air's critic at large, and we're talking about his list of 10 cultural trends from 2007. Number 7 on your list is hip sentimentality. What are you referring to?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened these days is that we have a lot of sentimental things in the culture. And I was thinking in particular about some movies this year, which I think are sentimental movies. Something like Knocked Up or Waitress or Juno. And you know, these are movies that people really like, but they in fact are very kind of squishy, soft at the center, but they're surrounded especially in the case of Knocked Up and Juno, by something that seems very kind of edgy. So in the case of Knocked Up, it's just deeply, deeply obscene. And in Juno, you have everybody speaking in a kind of hip patois. So like no one just talks about something. They actually are speaking this lingo that gives it an aura of hipness. Yet what's striking in these films is that there's a very basic situation that happens. You have three women with unwanted pregnancies. And in these three films put together, there's perhaps 30 seconds spent considering the possibility of abortion. That in fact, the whole thrust of all of these movies is to not deal with what it might actually mean to have an unwanted pregnancy, but to find ways of bringing together unlikely characters or to find ways of smoothing it all out so that you can have a happy ending. So in the case of Knocked Up, which is a film I should say that I liked, what's sentimental in it is that if you live in LA, you know that the Katherine Heigl TV person would never sleep with the Seth Rogen character, no matter how drunk she got.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. The second thing is that if she was pregnant with it, she would instantly be discussing abortion, even if she decided she wasn't going to do it, and it would be a serious discussion. And third, they wouldn't wind up binding in the same way. I think that's a very sentimental idea. And Juno has another version of that. It hasn't been out so long, so I don't want to spoil it for people. But there's that idea that somehow, actually, underneath it all, everything can be smoothed out in an emotional way, even though they're dealing with things that are really, really difficult.
So under this umbrella of hip sentimentality, do you think that hip and sentimentality are two words that used to not go together?
I think that it used to be that hip was anti-sentimental. And in probably some sort of way, sentimentality was anti-hip. But I think that one of the things that's happened is that we have learned as a culture, and cultures are very clever, how to take something which was old-fashioned, which I think is a sentimental crowd-pleaser, and dress it up in all the styles and lingos of hipness so that you can simultaneously look like you're really edgy and sharp and at the same time be presenting something that they would have been presenting back in the 1950s. And if it was presented in the way of the 1950s, would seem hopelessly square. So I do think that's the new cultural trend or cultural skill, which is to make something that seems perfectly mainstream and safe look slightly dangerous.
Number 8 on your list, The Nightly Ideological News.
Yes, I think what struck me this year was that we finally had the thing that was probably sort of foreshadowed by the arrival of Fox News. You know, when I was growing up, the news networks were ideological in some sense, but nobody felt about it that way. They thought that CBS, ABC, and NBC were essentially presenting the news straight. CNN came along, and for a long time people felt that, but it was clear that people on the right felt as though everything was slanted toward the left, and Fox News addressed that. For several years, Fox News was the only network that presented itself, or not, didn't present itself, but clearly was identified by people as being a conservative network. This year, two other networks clearly took on some sort of ideological slant. The more obvious of the two is MSNBC. Because of the success of Keith Olbermann's show, which appears every day, where he's been known to not only present the news, but to actually give editorials in a kind of Edward R. Murrow style, dressing down President Bush, that show became successful, and it nudged MSNBC toward becoming the liberal network. Suddenly, Chris Matthews sounds more liberal on the show than he had before Keith Olbermann was so popular. And then, almost at the same time, CNN began getting sort of populist. It's kind of right-wing populist, a little bit left-wing populist. And that's through the figure of Lou Dobbs. So just as Fox used to be identified mentally, I think, with Bill O'Reilly, MSNBC is now identified with Keith Olbermann, and CNN is identified with Lou Dobbs. And they're all carving out different areas of the ideological spectrum in a way that wasn't true even 2 or 3 years ago. You know, 2 or 3 years ago, all the articles in the media were about how CNN and MSNBC were trying to copy Fox and be conservative in that way, and that's no longer the case.
I mean, I think one of the things that might be going on in the actual news shows as opposed to the opinion analysis news talk shows is that the news shows seem to be getting more and more about features, self-help, things like along those lines.
Well, I think actually one of the trends I was actually going to talk about was the decline of news as news. So just as the nightly news things are now more likely to tell you about how to cure your cancer or how to lose weight, rather than covering straight news. And and newspapers are doing the same thing, and magazines are doing the same thing. You know, it's really eerie to pick up a copy of Newsweek and realize it's supposed to be a news magazine when it's constantly talking about something that doesn't really seem like news. What's scary in it for the culture is that the movement away from people actually reporting hard news means that we're going to get less and less hard news, especially if newspapers start failing. I mean, because it's much easier to have opinions. I know this. I'm a professional haver of opinions. I know it's easier to do what I do than it is to go to some foreign country and actually dig up what's actually happening. It's harder it's easier to do what I do than to do an investigative piece about the Pentagon or about some corporation. Those are hard things to do. To sit here and talk is pretty easy. Yet we're having a culture where increasingly the media is filled with people who do what I do, and fewer people can make a living doing the important stuff that gives the information that allows me to do what I do.
Our critic at large, John Powers, will be back in the second half of the show to finish his list of 10 cultural trends that emerged in 2007. John is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with our critic at large, John Powers. We're making our way through his list of 10 cultural trends that emerged in 2007. Number 9 on your list is atheist chic, which means?
Well, I guess what it means is that, you know, for a great many years, we have been hearing about religious fundamentalism abroad and evangelical Christianity here. And it was inevitable that there was going to be some sort of dialectical opposition to that. And it's taken the form of a series of big bestsellers that are arguing for the atheist point of view. I mean, Christopher Hitchens has one called God Is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. Richard Dawkins has a book called The God Delusion. And what you're actually seeing happening now is sort of our own little mini version of the Enlightenment, where you have the battle between those who defend religion and the battle between those who say that, in fact, religion is the enemy. Now, what's strange about this is that you're now seeing things, for example, on television that you would never see. I can't remember in my entire lifetime turning on a TV show, as I did recently, to see Lou Dobbs talking to Christopher Hitchens, and they're discussing whether or not God exists and whether or not every established religion is essentially a dangerous and bad thing. That's something we haven't had before. And it's clearly a response to the pure power of religiousness in our national life, because although many religious people in America feel that the U.S. is startlingly unreligious, if you go to any other modern developed country in the world, we are probably 5 or 10 times more religious in public than they are.
Well, number 10, the 10th and final item on your list of 10 cultural trends of 2007 is the writer's strike. What do you have to say about it?
Well, I guess the first thing I would say is that as a writer, I defend the writers. But I think it has something to do with everybody. I mean, you start off with the writers. If we take the writer's strike at the beginning, what that strike is essentially about is that as the way you deliver things to people changes, as you go from DVDs to, say, the internet, the writers want to have their share of the money that's made from this. And if the old contracts continue to exist, they won't get their share. Now, that shouldn't ordinarily matter to people out in the world, except that writers in lots of respects are like lots of other ordinary people whose jobs can somehow be outsourced, who new technologies can replace their work, that there is a way in which the writers really are like millions of other Americans who find that the shifting landscape of work is often leaving them behind. And that's what really is at the core of the writer's strike. You know, there's a deeper emotional core where writers feel they've been kicked around forever. And, you know, the great jokes of, you know, Hollywood is filled with jokes about writers. You know, the most famous joke, you know, probably about writers in Hollywood, is about the starlet who's so dumb she sleeps with the writer rather than with somebody powerful.
Yeah, one thing I find interesting about the public support that seems to exist for the writers who are striking is that this coincides with a time when a lot of people think everything on the internet should just be free. We shouldn't have to worry about musicians getting paid for their music. Their music should just be free on the internet.
Yes, I think that's actually one of the most interesting trends of probably of the last 10 years or maybe 15 years, is that you have a generation that's been raised with free content who expects it to be free. But rather, and this actually, if I may say, brings us back to something I was mentioning about the newspapers, which is that there's all this content being created in the world by people who are being paid to do it and spending long hours doing it. And if you actually stop paying them for that, they won't do it in the same way. You will still probably have rock bands, I grant you. But you probably won't. You won't have journalists. You won't have good, well-written TV shows, if people aren't going to get paid doing it. So there's an illusion somehow that you can actually make it all free because information wants to be free. But in fact, information may want to be free, but the people who create information want to be paid. And I'm certainly one of those people. That it terrifies me a little bit if people thought that everything I wrote they could instantly use for free, just because they could post it on the internet. I mean, I'm definitely opposed to that.
We've been looking back at 2007, particularly at cultural trends of 2007. I just want to spend a moment looking ahead to 2008, because early on next year in January, a show that I know you love, John, and that I love, The Wire, returns. And I can hardly wait.
Oh, I know. It is the thing I am most excited about in the culture that's coming up in the next 6 months. I think it's maybe my favorite TV show ever, partly because I think it does all the stuff that you want a TV show does, which is engross you and involve you and unfold in a way you can't quite guess, and at the same time reveal the world. And people, I guess, divide in life between mythological types and non-mythological types. I think for the non-mythological type, which I consider myself, a show like The Wire will always be better than a show like The Sopranos, in the same way that all my more mythologically inclined friends will always say that The Sopranos is better than The Wire. The one thing we both share in common is we all think The Wire is a really great show.
Well, John, thank you so much for talking with us, and I want to wish you happy holidays and a really happy and healthy new year.
Okay, no, and happy holidays to all our listeners. Thanks.
Thank you. John Powers is our critic at large and film critic for Vogue. This is Fresh Air.